Welcome to Dracena Wines Podcast. Our wines plus your moments equals great memories. I'm your host, Lori, and this is a podcast about all things wine. Welcome to episode 97 of Dracena Wines Podcast. It is wine season in New York City, and I am all in. While at Vin Expo, I attended a class on Beaujolais with advanced sommelier Arthur Hahn. Beaujolais is a wine region located just north of Lyon in eastern France. The 12 appellations have mostly granite soil and produce exceptional wines from the Gamay grape. In fact, 98% of the wines produced there are red. I was excited to attend this masterclass because I first fell in love with Beaujolais when Debbie Giaquindo and I did our second Wine for Vet Street episode, B is for Beaujolais. I will have a link to that episode in the show notes. And as always, I'm asking for a favor to scroll or swipe or whatever you need to do to get to that rate and review section and to leave us a review to help others find us. Thank you. Sláinte.
Welcome. So welcome for joining me for a really fantastic Beaujolais seminars today. I'm sure that many of you have tasted enough Beaujolais through Beaujolais, Beaujolais Village, enough Gamay. I'm sure that all of you are fans of this variety. And my name is Arthur Hahn. I was the assistant wine director at Union Square Cafe, and I'm starting as the beverage manager at Momoku Co. And before then, I was in Chicago managing the Michelin Stars program. Called Sepia, and so it's just a restaurant proxy for over a decade. I recently moved to Chicago, moved to New York a little bit over a year, almost a year and a half now. So, of course, there's the reason that we're kind of really focusing on Beaujolais today is probably a little atypical in terms of, I know that in the past, the recent years, there are a lot of sort of tasting throughout the entire 10 crews and kind of figure out the varieties and really choosing the distinct variable between one group and the others. Today we're going to do some of that as well. But what makes this is so interesting, so unique, is that the Wines of Beaujolais actually launched a new campaign for worldwide, in a sense, that kind of really bring in the culinary history background of this region into the wine itself. When we think about some of the most iconic French dishes, you know, we think of Lyonnaise, if you will. They're some of the most so iconic, so culinary things that we see, and all coming from this region, actually pairing up with the wine that can be so versatile in many, many senses. So really the lineup today is not necessarily sort of a breakdown in terms of one soil type versus the others, but really about their compatibility and versatility to the food itself as well. So more or less is something that's very easy to drink and fresh to something that makes you much more age-worthy and serious. And as we're tasting through the lineup in the second half of this, then you can kind of hopefully that will validate your own points in terms of why you fall in love with Beaujolais in the very first place. So how many of you actually come from outside of New York area? Well, welcome, great. And how from the outer side of coast, California, how far do you all come? Any from Midwest? Or that, okay. Anyone else further away? Up? Canada, great. So do you guys sell a lot of Beaujolais as well in your regions? I know that New York drinks a lot of Gamay overall. It's definitely one of the U.S. cities that I've seen so far are really heavily supporting this varieties. And this one's curious in terms of outside of sort of the New York, New Jersey sort of metropolitan areas, do we see the same trend as well? When I was in Chicago, we see a lot of sort of the new ways of the wine buyers and professionals kind of delve into. But this region is in itself, in a sense, where really about sort of the three things I summing up. It's about the great price, it's about the versatility, and it's still so far in the sense it's kind of underrated and underappreciated. And then, you know, you can really get a fantastic bottle of wines at a moderate price point that can work with a lot of different foods. And of course, in that kind of setting as well. And that's really something that I kind of want to go back, you know it already, but really kind of tasting through the entire lineup and while we talk about the next 45 minutes, really emphasizes points that, you know, it is more or less a sort of a wine community secret. I mean, there's a secret letting out more and more in terms of the mass consumer. But overall, it's really about how can we sort of pass on that message to a much more broader audience today. So one thing that kind of really sort of very simple and the statistics to kind of go over about the region, viticulture is still very important in this part of the world, and it has a heavy percentage of supporting that as well. And then one thing to kind of interesting to note is that 25% of these sort of wines are sold directly from the grower itself to the consumers, which is kind of not a testament to see, even though there's gaining popularity because there's still quite a bit of planting and all of that, and a sort of image changing from much more of a Beaujolais Nouveau to much more of the classic and driven more serious styles, there's still a lot of small producers, a lot of small producers who are still coming to US market that we still haven't seen or haven't seen enough yet. And then really quickly, of course, Beaujolais is located, you have really interesting sort of Massif Central next to it, and you have the river of Saône, and you're also very close to Lyon, and really creating both in a sort of a climate-wise and topography-wise and also sort of economical, sort of distance-wise, that you have this very interesting sort of sandwich, if you will. So you have one side, the foothills of Massif Central on the western end, then you have sort of the river Saône, the plain, that's sort of more the regulating sort of influence, and that you're so close to the second largest sort of metropolitan cities in France itself. And so right here within Beaujolais itself, you have, you know, of course, the crews, the 10 crews from north to south are designated with the darker purple. So the majority, so the, some of the most high quality ones that we're seeing are located in the northern part. Really quickly, some of the sort of, just to kind of make it more useful for you. So in terms of the crew-wise, it's the sort of total production vineyard planting roughly similar to Russian River Valley in Sonoma, if you want. And the total output for the entire region of 93 million bottles is roughly two-thirds of the output of California state in 2016. So kind of put it into perspective that overall the region is somewhat relatively small, but it has a really sort of larger output in the sense that a lot of these wines for the most part are kind of being really sort of the Beaujolais Nouveau style, really fresh, very easy to drink and all of that. And then in terms of the style is changing this region as we more and more people focusing on really sort of picking out some of the best and the most expressive styles between all these lands. So kind of talking about the climate influences that we just mentioned. So you have really have the oceanic coming from the Atlantic Ocean, coming from the western part, bringing through the air circulation movement. So of course, in this case, you gotta know that, you know, the villages closer to the foothills of the Massif Central is going to have more of a higher rainfall. And as we move away, we have a lesser rainfall on the eastern side. And of course, because of the two mountains ranges really show through to kind of create a channel. And the river Saône that really bring in the dry Mediterranean wind as well. So it's really kind of very interesting dynamic looking at such a smaller wine region compared to, of course, the closest neighbor up north of the part of Burgundy, and the south, of course, to south of Rome, if you will. And of course, you have very sort of cold wind, continental wind coming from the Alps and coming from the sort of whole of the eastern side of France. And all of these create a very sort of interesting, very extreme temperature variations between summer and winter, of course. Then you have the rainfall, which we talk about. So it's roughly between the lowest, it's about 29 inch annually, to range the highest to about 39 annually inch. So moderate sort of kind of spread out sort of rainfall patterns. So of course, a little heavier during the fall, a little bit heavier during the spring, but overall it's quite spread out in terms of when the rainfall during this regions. And then why does this also, because this part of the mountain really serve as the protections from the winds coming from the north and the river itself. So you have this like two extremes on one side, but at the same time you also have this regulating factors protecting the region itself. So what you're gonna see is, as we know, Gamay is not a typically sort of high acid variety itself, and that's, or one can argue, you know, that's sort of the lesser comparable to Pinot Noir. But because of this protecting factors and because of extreme temperature shifts and all of that, we create this perfect climate for them, it's really showcasing itself in a both just a wonderful way that maintaining that foodier characteristics. You're picking a lot of sort of soil type differences. At the same time, you have that wonderful sort of acidity to really balance everything up. And of course, the two major varieties, Gamay Noir Arjuna. Of course, that's the full name, official name for Gamay. This variety is a very ancient, old cultivar, and it's some of the sort of earliest mentioning where it's been traced back to sort of the mid to the end of 14th century. And then, of course, at the end of the 14th century, the Duke of Burgundy basically banned the growing of Gamay because considered as more of a lesser to the quality of Pinot Noir, and Burgundy is known for fantastic wine, so therefore Gamay should exist. And of course, moving to the much more southern areas. But throughout these studies, you know, Gamay, of course, coming from some of the two, so the marriage of two varieties, and just some of the very similar, and it's just sort of natural mutations of that. And but again, something that's very old, has to survive for quite some time, all before the phylloxera, if you will. And to kind of really talk about sort of the variety itself, and especially we're in the heart of a part of France where it's so well known for wine and food, and of course, sort of the terroir, if you will. So it's actually quite interesting because there's a lot more major focuses on the region itself. The wines of Bordeaux actually starting with the review of the sort of vine management, really kind of finding out what are some of the best ways push the region collectively as a whole for the better, if you will. So this is, you know, some steps are kind of taken into consideration, so really enforcing what are some of the best viticulture practices, how can they reduce waste in terms of winemaking threading different process, and all of that to really maintain the quality, and that's really truly really the key. And I think that looking at the transition between the Beaujolais that, you know, we enjoy early on, let's say, you know, 50s and onwards, when it really becomes much more popular here in the US and globally, and to the Beaujolais that we know now, you know, that has a very sort of dynamic shift in terms of before was something that's truly just young and fresh and easy to drink. But at this point, it's like really about how can you find the good quality, and also we start talking about vintage variations as well, which is very, very present in the last couple of years, especially sort of unexpected weather patterns in the past 2 years with the hail. It's very exciting to actually a wine that we'll be tasting today that both be 16s and 17s. And of course, that you all have probably read through quite a bit, our two vintages we've been talking about quite a bit, especially quality of the 16 and the 15, where it considers because the hail impacted so much of the region itself, but then they were able to pull out some of the really fantastic wines. And of course, something very interesting to know is that even though it is a region that allows mechanic harvesting, but somewhat, you know, the manual hand harvesting is still some of the most common, and it really sort of one key component to maintaining the quality of the wine that we are seeing in this region as well. So really quickly, kind of going through the winemaking process, you'll know this already, I shouldn't talk too much. So of course, the most well-known is the carbonic maceration, so this is really started in this region, and in fact, even that aromatic uplift. So basically why it does, of course, the entire clusters are pulled into the tank itself, and then ferment, and then because of the temperature differences between the tank and also the berry itself, you have this like molecular levels of extractions, which are much more gentler in terms of the tannin extractions, and you get a visual uplift of floral components, and people can say bananas, pear drops, and always that kind of bubblegum kind of flavor component, but at the same time also maintain low in alcohol, and give us a really distinct purple sort of magenta hue, if you will. But I think that some of these wines that we're tasting today are mostly kind of fall into much more of a classic, what they call Burgundian style winemaking, where the wines are or withstand inclusions, semi-carbonic for the Pinot case, where they kind of will load the berries, so the berries on the very end, very bottom of the vest, will start to ferment that creates sort of a semi-carbonic zone, if you will, for the entire fermentation process. And what it has is that you have this combination of both. You have this sort of uplift of floral components, the acid, but at the same time you have much more sort of age-worthy end product in this case. And the wines of Bordeaux. So again, it's a region, you know, quite long its length, but for the most part it's really about sort of top parts, some of the wine that we'll be tasting today. Rice is really just rice out of Mâcon, So the wines are, of course, both white and reds are produced, but mostly with red wines, about 89% reds and 2% whites. So the whole thing is not classified into sort of two things. So the previous slide shows you that this entire Beaujolais Nouveau, of course, it can produce anywhere, and moving on to the village level, of course, something a little more precise, and then, of course, with crew as well. And as you see that with the Beaujolais Village and the Beaujolais Cruz, are red wine produced. And we kind of talk about some vintages. So it's kind of interesting to know that 2009, 2010, very consistent. Again, 11, 12, a little bit more complicated. Personally, it's kind of really fun. And the 13 is actually one of my favorites in terms of savory and the fruit components. 14, of course, and then 15, really sort of bold and rich and juicy vintages. And then moving to around sort of 16, and then now some of the 17 they'll be tasting. So overall, that you're seeing a very sort of consistent span of vintages. And how many of you actually work with older vintages of Cru Beaujolais? Do you like them? Do you feel like people get them? Or do you get the question?
Some people do,
yeah.
Yes.
And in your opinion, and then sort of in your experience, how do they age?
Fairly well. The oldest one I've had was from 1978.
Okay.
Actually,
great.
It was beautiful.
Perfect. So you see a lot of, do people see a lot of vintage variations as they're tasting through some, you know, some like 5-year-old, 6-year-old Cru Beaujolais? How many of you have never tasted older vintages of Beaujolais at all? Perfect. Well, I think that they are, we will not have examples of that, but I think one thing to very easy to seek out is that we talk about sort of, you know, as you run different programs, having different kind of buyers or on-premise or off-premise, one way to really, really quickly add vintage sort of variations, you know, kind of diversity on your list is that Beaujolais still offers a really good value point, especially in older vintages. And, you know, some producers do age quite well. And I was tasting some of the Cru itself, especially kind of towards into the Morgon, Moulin Avant, some of the really well-known Cru itself. Of course, there's reason why they're being compared to Burgundy, to some of the Bourgogne regions, just because they do have the ability to age as well. Personally, I do like them quite fun. There is sort of fun to drink Beaujolais when they are fresh, but they're also kind of fun to see how they evolve over time. And it's sometimes going back to the spirit of sharing, so the sort of the Bourgognonomie, the spirit, if you will, it's really truly a capital where French foods and the very local wines are come together. So one thing we didn't talk about earlier is sort of the concept of couchons in this region. So it's a region that's served local foods, served with local wines, and something that you can get sort of the pâtés, the sausages, you know, things are some of the really iconic things are coming from this region, and that's where people gravitate. And of course, the wine itself also becoming sort of the darlings of the French Parisian wine scenes as well. And it's really about really the expressiveness of how easy they are drinking. And overall, it's, you know, it's the diversity and sort of the spectrums of things that can make us fall in love with Beaujolais. So the whole thing that kind of, you know, really quickly, don't really need to delve much too into it, is that as you're tasting through the wine, I kind of want you to think about two things. One is that, are they more of the generosity, more expressive camp of the variety and, you know, and why you think of Gamay itself. And the other side is that sort of the antithesis is a little bit serious. Things like, you know, you're drinking really well now, but you like to hold on to maybe for a few years and see how they evolve. And so keep that in mind, sort of the duality of this, the wines I'll be tasting. And maybe there are some kind of candied both. That wine that drink beautiful now has a lot of expressive sort of a generosity to it. But at the same time, you also feel like an age for quite some time. So this, the things that we're talking about really is about sharing, it's about creating atmospheres when we're drinking Beaujolais. How many of you actually drank a bottle of Beaujolais just in the past month? Last week? This week? Great. So it's, you know, do you drink it by yourself? Do you drink it with a group of friends? Do you drink it with both? Do you have any preference? Both? So what makes you want to go drink a Beaujolais? What makes you so attractive to this regional variety? Please, everybody, crowd pleasing, right? So you're not really gonna find area where it's like you're not gonna like it, but it's really good. Anything, any other inputs?
Yeah, I think
pairs, right? Food, fish, vegetables, heavier meat, different preparation as well, saute, grill, cream. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So exactly, light, spotty red wines, fairly low in alcohol, which I've seen know that low in alcohol always really good with food in the context of that, and also feeling really good, sort of acidity. You know, everything just kind of in the center, everybody's happy, yes.
Uh-huh. But they're not so complex that someone who does not know a lot about wine
perfect.
Still really enjoy
excellent.
Them as well.
It's another very valid point is that sort of the has the complexity that we all really love when we're kind of geeking out when we're tasting, but at the same time there has a sort of general accessibility that everybody can get into it if you just first got into drinking real wine. How many of you actually haven't tasted a lot of Gamay or Beaujolais? Great, so hopefully that by the end of this, half an hour or so, that you will, find more about why maybe you should or shouldn't, enjoy Beaujolais stuff. So really, that this is a really fun way of thinking Beaujolais, that kind of getting away from a little bit more sort of academic approach that has been happening quite often, but really kind of bringing out sort of accessibilities, the food, and all of that, because we kind of forgot, I love Côte d'Ivoire, in general, when I think that a really classic French bistro, which are less than hard and hard to find nowadays, and Côte d'Ivoire, of course, one of the very classic dish that coming out of this region. So kind of we talked about this already, carbonic macerations, which give you a more of an uplift, juicier expressions, easier to drink or enjoy younger. And as you're using less and less of carbonic or combination carbonic and sort of quote unquote the Burgundian style, more traditional winemaking techniques, then you become sort of increasing the ageability of the wine itself. So the really sort of comes to a really simple breakdown in terms of what crews are considered as, in whichever camp. And of course, Bocuse, one of the most highly regarded French chefs, has this restaurant here in Lyon.
Looking to be in the know about Dracena wines? Want to know when we release our new wines? Find out about all of our accolades and get some behind-the-scenes information? Well, all you need to do is sign up for our newsletter. There is no commitment necessary, and I promise you we won't spam your mailbox with loads of messages. Need another reason to sign up? Quite possibly the best reason? You will immediately get a code for a special discount on all of our wines and be privy to newsletter-only specials. Let Dracena Wines turn your moments into great memories. Sign up simply by heading to our website, dracenawines.com, and fill out the pop-up or sidebar. It will take less than a minute of your time, but the rewards will last forever.
Perfect. So now kind of gets to the tasting part of the wine. So you all have your tasting book. I believe the wines are listed exactly as it appears. And again, don't really worry about sort of expressive, exceptional notes, but again, for your own opinions, interest, do you think these wines are much more of the general things I can drink, like what we talk about, accessibility, that you can drink in with a group of people, people who are maybe novice when it comes to wine, or things that are even sort of the complexities and all that pleases you as a wine professional as well. So we kind of mentioned really quickly at the very beginning that there's mostly high, so 98% of the wine produced here in Beaujolais are red wines, mostly of Gamay varieties, but we do have white wine produced, and there's some rosé as well, and there's some sparkling coming out as well. And so here, one of the really classic producers that I have worked in the past, coming from sort of the opposite end of the Beaujolais coming from, so he's Jean-Paul Boone's winery is actually located on the much more southern part of this region. So it's a region that has yet to be sort of tapped in. And this is very sort of traditional style of winemaking, the 100% Chardonnays. I mean, Chardonnay itself is still one of the most popular white grapes here in the US market or in the worldwide to some extent. But I feel like, at least from where I'm seeing in terms of the on-premise, there is definitely a trend moving away from much more of the opulent style, especially for more of the price point reasons or things are, you can drink it more. And I feel like especially millennials, consumers are kind of moving away from what their parents are drinking, but they're more willing to open up to other expressions of the Chardonnay itself. And I think that this wine itself definitely provided that. It's very fresh, has a lot of food components to it, sort of generosity and stuff, but it seems to also you feel like it does come from a very specific place. Any thoughts on this wine? Does it please you? How many of you think of this as much more than a sort of general expressive can? The more complex can? Somewhere in the middle, both? You couldn't quite figure out what the wine is? It does use oak barrel, so what you're getting is really texture, so not a lot of oak aromas at all. So yeah, so the older barrels are in the wine itself, but again, it's really the textures that you're getting as opposed to the aromas. Again, as you're tasting, it's really sort of that the acidity, the expressiveness. For me, it's kind of like right in between as well. It has a lot of sort of things that you want with wine. I feel like if you pour a glass of this Chardonnay to people who never really had good Chardonnay would say they don't like Chardonnays, probably won't get them into Chardonnay back again. But at the same time, that if you want to, you know, as a wine professional, that you're looking, seeking out the complexity yourself, I feel like this, you know, I'll be very happy to drink a glass or a bottle of this myself. So kind of moving on to the second wine. So we talk about Beaujolais in general, so sort of the two things. You have a Beaujolais overall, a general AOP, as you know, can make one pretty much the entire wine regions. Then you have the Beaujolais villages, which are slightly more, you can blend different villages together. In this case, slightly more of distinct in terms of terroirs. And the Domaine de Mahon is sort of a wine region is located in Flory, so it's one of the northeastern part of the pool. So they are right here. So Flory, the light blue, kind of right in the sort of northern heart of this region. And what makes Flory so interesting is that the soil type, as you're gonna see, probably not here, but later on. So it's like, you know, so we talk about soil type in Beaujolais, so you have the three things. So you have the granite, you have the schist, and then you have the clay. And the combinations of all of those. And you're gonna see that some crew that they are more sort of blend of all these three and more different soil types, and there are crew that are more distinctly one or the others. And so in the heart of sort of Flory itself, it's are much more of the sort of granite dominated soil. So why this is like for me, it's had this really kind of beautiful structure, kind of bring everything back in. And also sort of really beautiful sort of leaf lip as well. So again, it's a very sort of traditional winemaking technique, hand harvesting, using very small crate to minimize any kind of oxidation, so bruising to the berry itself. And sort of old school, they use some carbonic maceration. And so it does have a little bit sort of floral uplift and fruit components to it. And really just really hands off. Everything about this wineries are done in a sort of very natural, traditional way, so really letting the fruit showcase itself. How many of you think this is more expressive and more so everybody please everyone can? More complex and more sort of complex and serious can? Somewhere in the middle? Do you like them? Do you like the wine? It's really easy to drink, right? Really pretty, again, kind of reinforcing that you really do can drink this with a lot of different things and that you have this structure of the wine itself, it's there. But at the same time, there's a sort of generosity in the mid-palate. And I think that a lot of times that we American and, you know, to a certain degree that we drink wine too young. So I feel like you drink some of the really beautiful wine, especially Burgundy itself, that, you know, especially current releases as well, that you can see the framework with the potential of the wine itself, that you know, the acid and structures, everything's there. But the mid-palate is kind of hollow. Like, you know that it's going to take some time to develop. You know, it's going to be great as it fills in. But you know, you do have to waste some time. But I feel like so far, the two Beaujolais that we tasted are the mid palate, that's sort of the suppleness that really sinks the meat on the bone itself are really kind of filled in already. It's really approachable and really fresh. And again, with the one vintage, 1 year back, but it, you know, still very sort of really kind of showcasing well in terms of what, you know, even though a Beaujolais Village level wine can do really well. And this is sort of really, again, not too oaky. The influence of oak is very minimum here. It's really about the textures and the freshness of it. So I was getting more and more serious and all of that. So we're kind of going into some of the crews here now. So as you can see, so really quickly, do you have, I believe there's a map in your tasting sheet? But if not, really quickly, kind of we're running through some of that, you know. On the very top, you have sort of the split between Saint Amour and Juliana. They're almost side by side, sort of the lighter red and also darker, more of an irony blood, sort of ox blood kind of color. And moving on to Chenasse, it's one of the sort of most elusive crudes. If you will, you can find not a lot of examples still in the current market. But then right below that sort of darker blue, more teal colors, you have the Moulin Avant, so one of the most iconic crew that you see a lot of, some of the best known producers that have wines, and some of the pricing are more demanding to some really good Burgundies. Moving on to Floris, which we kind of tasted in one number two, the lighter green. It's a really sort of beautiful, sort of very distinct sort of the crew where you have mostly granite soils here, and it's always like, you know, like, remind me like flowers. Very up, very easy to drink, has a really bright sort of characteristic to the wine itself. And Cherub, sort of one of the most elusive examples of Cherub as well. And it has sort of really kind of mixtures of different soils. And we do not have examples of that. And again, really quickly, following through some of the really well-known examples of the Cherub. So you have Morgons, again, one of the most sort of considered as very sort of staid. Rennies, again, kind of in between me, it's almost like between Floris, a little bit of Bulgars. And then you have sort of two sort of twins, well, brothers or sisters. You have the Bruy, sort of lighter orange, and with the Côte d'Ivoire, sort of the peak, the mountains surrounding the peak of the mountains down there, some highly elevation, so the darker orange there. So really, those 10 crews comprise some of the most beautiful examples here. So we're looking at the southern part in the regions of Bruy, so one of the largest sort of crew here. And Bruy, because in the southern part, so remember, the wind blows through here through the Saône River. Then you have the foothills that, you know, so Bruy is slightly away from the Massif Central, the central foothills, and it's a little less protected from sort of the mountain side on the north for the from the northern wind. So what you have generally is a little bit more riper expressions of that. One thing we didn't mention earlier is that because sort of the 1 point of the kind of farmer, a lot of 25% of growers still selling their wine directly to the consumers, there is a sort of négociant plays a major part in these regions. It doesn't, you know, I feel like in the sense that nowadays that we kind of think of négos, it's like, oh, that's probably not very good, you know, they buy wines and all that. But in this region, so the foundations of Bordelais were built by the négos in this case. One of the oldest, the négociants, Louis Tet, in this region, is because of them, they really kind of push the Bourgeois Nouveau movement, especially with the Louis Chateau, Dubuff in the 70s, really kind of has really sort of fantastic marketing schemes, and that really pushed the wine region. So now you see a lot of Nouveau everywhere, that people want to do this fresh release, the earlier release, while they let the rest of the wine resting and finish fermentations and all of that. So just, what do you think? Is this more of an expressive camp? Is this much more of a serious camp? Is this again more of a middle of the road camp? More expressive? Serious, okay. And why do you think it's more serious? More not a true, exactly. A little more sort of density, right? A little bit more heavy, a little bit meatier. And kind of, again, coming back to the reason that we talk about Bruy is that one of the southernmost part of the crew does get a little warmer because of the drier winds, and it's sort of, you know, less away from the sort of Massif Central, and also you're less protection coming from the north. And so while you have a little more density to the wine itself, but overall it's really juicy, right? Does anybody think this wine is, you know, do you like this wine the best so far? Come forth. Any favorites so far, the first three? You just love it so much, you like just keep drinking it? All right, so let's continue to getting more and more serious in a sense. So here you can really see Bruy, you know, so for the most part, you can't really see the detail, but just remember the color. So when you see more of a pinkish and more so coral colors, those are sort of indications of the granite style soils. And when you see more of a bluish color, those are schist soil. And when you see more of the like yellow, kind of yellow greenish, those are the limestone. So what you're seeing is that you have a region that really has sort of distinct two side view, because you have the western side closer to the foothills of the Massif Central, so you have very distinct granite and granite-related soils. And as you moved away, because of the river Saoong view, you have more of a limestone, you have much more of alluvial, you have mixtures of soil on the western side. So Côte d'Ivoire, in a sense, is one of the very, very sort of complex sort of soil diversity. And what it gives is that this very general round that doesn't taste like very distinct one or the other, but it's really expressive in a sense of very sort of generous on the palate. The year? The last wines? So Domaine Marron is for Beaujolais, but the winery itself is located in Fleury. So Brewery is all, so that's everything that you see, the colored part, so the sort of southwest to southeast part. Oh, the wine itself, unfortunately, I don't have that information. Kind of sourced throughout the producer, because they get some Nico's project, so they do source throughout both side combinations. So they have winery on the granite side, and also the winery located on the, exactly. So what you get is not neither one expression of Brie, but much more of the general ideas of the Brie. So I was moving, kind of, you know, upgrading, so sort of the different soil type. So kind of quickly, so looking at Rigny, so one of my favorites, Cru, because that is still not quite as popular. The price-wise is still somewhere in the middle. But what you see is that, again, it's really singular in terms of the color. So we talk about much more of, you know, the pink and coral color. So it's mostly granite. And so I will let you taste this wine first, and then kind of see if you can, you know, if you feel the sort of how it's different than compared to the previous one, where it gives you a little bit more sort of broader diversity, and this is much more pinpoint. Anything that you notice a little different? The wine making techniques are very similar and very comparable. Again, very traditional way of approaching this variety. Both of them are 16s. Do you think that this is more serious? Or do you think this is still more very general and very expressive? General, expressive, okay. Anyone else on this side? Serious, right? Are we kind of getting that dryness, that sensation, right? A little bit acid is brighter, very sort of pinpoint and distinct. And it really is, you know, really sort of very good expressions of the sort of granite. So really giving you that, almost like stony. For me, it's like almost like looking at rock, the hard rocks, if you will. It's a very precise, very pinpoint. But at the same time, there's also fruit and juiciness kind of filled into the mid palate. But again, a little bit more, you kind of want to eat food with this wine, as opposed to the previous one. You probably can drink it without eating anything. Everyone, do you all like this wine? You like the previous one better? No? Do you like this wine? A little more serious, right? So what makes you want to like this one more? Complexity, a little bit of the lengthier finish, right? There's much more going on. The previous two are kind of fun, they smell good, they smell aromatic, but the finish is not quite as sort of precise and sort of long and more complexity. For sure. And it's just kind of really fun, because as you can see that, you know, there's a reason why it's a really good comparison. Like here, the second one, Domaine Marron, is a Beaujolais village. You know, and it's, even though it is blended of all the villages together, but in the sense that they are not necessarily has the more singular voice, but as you're moving toward more of the Rigny, and you know, you can see sort of progressions and sort of the more complexity and more sort of singularity of these wines sort of comes through, that you can really see a clear and clear picture of the Gamay variety. And kind of moving on, so one of the most elusive appellation coming from the north. And looking at this aerial map, it's like, oh wow, really, again, very diverse soil type. So you have, so the pink granite, so really locating on the top, so you kind of all, everything merges. You have the sort of northwestern side, and you have the Massif Central, so the granite, if you will. Then, you know, really closely to the River Saoong, so you have all the alluvial deposits and all of that. And so in this case, like, you really kind of a hodgepodge of everything and anything is possible. Sonomore is one of the most complex sort of soil diversity crew in this case. And let's take to see if you can really find that really showcasing in the wine itself. Do you feel like this is closer to the previous wine? Or do you feel like this is more closer to the first two reds? Or there's some combinations of both? Much darker, right? More concentrated, right? There's definitely a little bit more concentrated. And one thing that's really good to mention is that 2007 was a really sort of wacky vintage, and where the hails were really sort of devastated the region itself. So when that happened, is that the winemaker, as you know, that you have less to work with in terms of raw materials. But what you can do is that you can really pick and choose. can really get the best of the best, in a sense, make the wine for that year. So what you're seeing is that the concentrations are being showed through 2017 compared to 2016. At the same time, it has really density itself that really just more structured. So we kind of, quite tannic, right? But it's not oak tannins at the point. It's just really just, you know, firm, you know, almost like you really do want to eat croquevin, you really want to eat the pate and sausages, right? And the things, and for the, exactly, yeah. You know, next time we'll have some food right in front of you. But you can understand that these are, again, a wine that, yes, you can drink on its own, but at the same time, it does, we're gonna work and think about all the food that will be coming from this region that really makes sense as well. Would you drink this with seafood prepared in cream sauce? Seafood and tomatoes, great. Yeah, exactly. So again, I feel like with Beaujolais, and one thing that I kind of want to mention is that it's one of the wines that is really fun to play with serving temperature. I feel like, you know, there's when you're drinking very heavy red wine, let's say Cabernet Sauvignon from Bordeaux or from California, you have to serve it at a slightly warmer temperature, just because as the tannin shuts down, everything kind of just closed up when you serve it too cold. But with Beaujolais, you can understand that if we're serving this wine and bringing the temperature down, the sort of effect of tannins will be a little less, and while you have an acid will be a little bit brighter. So you can kind of imagine that if you're serving maybe say like tuna grilled or swordfish with a cream sauce, or any kind of tomato that goes with that, or something that will grill potentially, so even so with heavier seafood, yes, it will have a lot of compact flexibility in terms of that. So kind of going back to the point that some people we brought up, that it really is a wine that you can drink with a lot of different people in the restaurants that were moderate price, and then you can drink with multiple different kind of foods. Is this your favorite wine so far? Yeah, most like I'm still tasting the wine, right? So very complex. So moving on, so getting more and more serious. So we're looking at slightly higher up elevations of the Brie, if you will. So the dark orange part of this region, so much more highly elevated, not highly, but much more elevated. So you get very distinct sort of two sides right here. So you have around the mound of the Brie, if you will, you have more of a schist soil, so kind of the blue and sort of the teal colors. And on the one side, you have much more of the granite soils. No, I don't think there's any crew designations. Basically you see is Brie. It's Brie in the sense that it's almost like you're seeing the Pouliguen Marché, if you will. It's like that itself as it's the village name and appellation name, and it was designated as higher. More delimited area in comparison to Beaujolais or Beaujolais Village. Oh, exactly. Oh, Côte de Brie, exactly. So those are two. The question was that, so Brie and Côte de Brie are actually two different appellations. One is actually being designated by higher elevation, basically the foothill of the Mount Ifiwa, and it compares to the Côte de Brie picture that we're seeing. So the one that in the middle, the white gray part, that's Côte de Brie. So you're seeing sort of the outer span of the region that are encompassing Brie, that makes sense. So the one that's in your glass right now is higher elevation. So right now it's actually the part that you're not seeing, so kind of whited out in the middle. And that's this. So remember when we're tasting Brie, so you have some wine, really that kind of roundness, that really generosity, you know, coming from more of the foothill and outliers of that. And this is almost like all those components, but just a little bit more serious. This acid is much brighter, everything is more elevated and more lit, and you feel like this kind of sappy, sort of snappy for juiciness that keep wanting, kind of pulling you back. You can definitely drink more of it, and you can drink alone, and you can also drink it with food. How many of you think this is more expressive? Yeah, perfect. Serious? Both? Right? This drinks really well, like again, tuna with, you know, tomato sauce, you know, fish with some kind of cream sauce. Again, the acid and all of that really will, you know, kind of brighten things up. And if we serve it this slightly chilled as well, it'd be really fun, you know, especially in the summer months as well. So again, don't be one thing that's really encouraging to play with the temperature of this one where you're serving Beaujolais. It really can make a huge impact. Moving into the last two wines, and the last two are some of the most sort of iconic and really well respected crew is some of the things that, you know, when we talk about crew Beaujolais, some of the most well-known crew and has a lot of examples of are coming from the last two. So the first one is Morgon. So Morgon, of course, looking at the mess, the dark purple ones, located in the center of sort of 10 crews, if you will. And when you're looking at this Morgon, very sort of interesting sort of split, right? So you have this, toward the northern western portion, you have a lot more sort of granite, but you have this really sort of tiny, almost like oval shape of the schist, which are some of the well-known sort of the clima, if you will, the regions of vineyard sites called Côte d'Ipine, and are in strictly schist soil. So within this sort of schist area, slightly whole higher elevated area, so you have several different clima or special vineyard designation, if you will. We're actually tasting one of them today. So the example that you have, Grand Cru. So Grand Cru is actually looking at the southern west part, right here, region. So you have definitely a very good sun exposure, about mid-hills. And what you have is that really sort of density to the wine itself. It's, you know, you can understand that sometimes people compare Morgon to some of the really good sort of Burgundy producers, the Pinot Noir, if you will, coming from. So Grand Cru is actually one of the Pima within the Côte d'Ipine region, so it's actually around here. What do you think? Serious? So it's still very drinkable, right? You don't feel like you have to wait for this wine to come around, but it's still, that, you know, compared to the previous one, we talk about that sort of the structure, the snappy acidity, that and all of that, but it's almost a little bit more darker, a little more meatier, a little more broodier as well. Why does so much more ruby colors and comparison to the previous one? You mean a little bit more darker in hue? So the question was why this wine is a little bit darker. Perfect. So one really good thing about why, so you're comparing glass 6 and 7, right? Perfect. So one thing that you're seeing that more purple-ish hue is, for me, is indications of semi-carbonic macerations. So that in the wines of the Côte d'Ivoire, there's less, a little bit heavier in terms of the semi-carbonic maceration. So why is this? Is that you have the snappiness of that juicy that you're tasting, but you also have the acidity to bring the wine. So that's why you see much more of a, almost a purple bluish hue as opposed to the Morgon, which is much more ruby color. And sort of moving on to the very last one, the Moulin Avant. So we're looking at somewhere a little bit further north in comparison where we were Morgon, so in the sort of dark teal color. So again, one of the most sought after crews, and always sort of more, you know, considered as more of the Burgundian style as opposed to sort of, you know, the Julianas or even the Brie, which is more that juicier quality itself. So portion of the grapes are stems as opposed to so there's some stem inclusions, so in this case that some carbonic maceration, semi-carbonic is used in this wine. And the one again, so really using older oak to aid the ageability of these wines as well. And looking at the soil type, again, we're kind of moving on to much more of a singular style soil of mostly granite here. So, you know, you want to compare is that Rennes was the last wine that we tasted in this flight has much more predominantly true one sort of singular soil type within the entire Appalachian. Your thoughts? Kind of bringing back, right? So you have that more firmer, more like linear kind of structure as opposed to the previous one that was a little more broader and denser, more broodier. When comparison to the Côte d'Ivoire, where the Brie is a little more rounder, more generous, and more broad. And this is really just very linear, has that structure really framing the wine itself. And you kind of see that why some, you know, a lot of people do agree that this wine is, you know, in some from some producers and from the vintages, when it's good, it's really spot on. It's lean, but it's also not, it's not light, right? It's lean, but it's not light, yes. It's a very lean wine, firm, but it's not a light wine. Very different than, you know, the Beaujolais Village that we tasted earlier, so even the Brie that we tasted earlier, right? Those are light and fresh, but this is like light, but also dense at the same time. So do you think this is more serious, or do you think it's more serious? Do you like it? You can still drink with a lot of different foods, right? Everything that you can. Structure, you have, You don't like it? You love it. Perfect. So really, that's it. This is really truly sort of the really broad spectrum of wine, and kind of really focusing on Beaujolais in, you know, in a sense where that, yes, there is typicity. There is sort of very singular voices between all of these crews or regions, if you will. But at the same time, they're also showcasing a variety that can both be fun and be very serious, and everything in between. And what, you know, kind of want you to really remember and really continue, don't forget, is that Côte d'Ivoire, of course. Well, food, it's really a major part. You know, wine is about the combinations of all this. Yes. And as you're kind of moving on to more of a serious, so especially the oak usage, so the question is like, do you get more oak usage? Yes, you do, especially when looking at more Gaume Moulin en Vin, some of the more serious and age-worthy regions, so we do see more of the, not oaky in any way, but there is more of the firmer tannin structure coming through. Retail pricing, do we have any information of that? I would say that retail pricing, so really quickly, some of these are probably wholesale 15 to 25 ranges, so retail times 1.7, more or less. So looking at like, you can range from like 25 to 30, 23, yeah. So exactly, looking at very comfortable, some of the really comfortable price point where that if you have, you know, novice or serious drinker that you're looking to cook some food, grab a bottle, that you know that for the most part you're not gonna go around, and if you have a really quick dinner party, you're gonna be fantastic as well. Very good question. The question was that comparing wine A and wine B, does region trump producers? And so in the case of Beaujolais, what do you think? Does the region trump producers? Do you thought of different crews, or do you thought of more producers, or do you think this is more equal, half and half? More regions, or more the locations, okay, for you? I think for Beaujolais, it's pretty much, yeah, because you either, I mean, there are some regions that are, you know, that more easy to drink, right? And there are regions such as Moulin en Vin or Morgon that you actually seek out producers. But when you're seeking out producer, you also know that you're paying a much higher price as well in comparison to a more of a general Beaujolais as well. So as you know, this lady mentioned that, you know, the wines are mostly ranged from low 20s to like mid 20s to maybe $30. But we're looking at some of the best producers in these regions, they much higher pricing. Some of them can maybe be like $60 or $70 wholesale. So there are definitely a price jumps, and that's why sort of the vintage variation comes into part, and also ageability comes into part as well. Do they make any sparkling wines? Yes, they do. Not a lot, but there is some sparkling coming out of this region. There's more and more people are experimenting as well. So there are free producers are playing with that. It's not as broad spectrum in terms of what we see in other wine regions, but more or less Beaujolais specifically, thus absolutely fantastic sparkling coming out. Perfect, thank you for joining me for an afternoon of Gamay, and you know, drink more.
Thanks for listening to Dracaena Wines Podcast. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like us to discuss, please reach out to us on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, YouTube, Facebook, Snapchat, Google, and Periscope as @DracaenaWines. I am also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Budd, or email us at DracaenaWines.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find us more easily. We are found on all of your favorite aggregators. To subscribe easily to iTunes, go to bit.ly/DracaenaPodcast. That's bit.ly/DracaenaPodcast. And that's a capital D for Dracaena and capital P for podcast. Please check out our award-winning wines and find out about our wine club at DracaenaWines.com. And remember to always pursue your passion. Sláinte!